Today on Wings, Venezuela Inside Out.
We are talking about a people who are very well educated, who has high levels of political understanding. You cannot just assume that because the United States said that they have a new president, they will just follow this person.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Code Pink is a women-led grassroots organization founded to stop U.S. wars and militarism and support peace and human rights initiatives. In early 2019, as international governments and media began building the case for intervention in Venezuela, Code Pink contacted an experienced analyst on hemispheric affairs. Here are excerpts from that interview, streamed live between Los Angeles and Caracas.
Welcome, everyone, on our Facebook Live. This is Jody Evans, one of the co-founders of Code Pink. And I'm here with Aline Piva, who is a Brazilian journalist, policy analyst, and a law professor at the Bolivarian University in Venezuela. Aline's on the ground in Venezuela, and you know, we see so many things from afar, and I worry about you. So how are you?
You know, Juan Guaido self-nominated himself as president of Venezuela on the 23. My father called me the next morning and he was very upset, and he was saying, please come home. I don't want you in the middle of a civil war or anything. And I think that's really interesting, because when you go to the streets of Caracas, there is definitely some tension, some focus of violence. People are very worried about what could happen internationally. I mean, is the United States going to attack, or Brazil or Colombia? But in the streets, we are not on the brink of civil war. There are some level of normality going on.
You know, I remember 2002, the coup, and 2003, and then 2016, and definitely the right was fomenting a lot of violence. Are you seeing that same level of violence?
There are some violence. For example, a couple of days ago, a young man from the government's party in the base, he was shot, and then he got his body burned by some people of the opposition. But we are not seeing the same levels of violence in the streets as 2002, 2013, 2016. What we are seeing, though, is that it's kind of a more planned focus of violence. For example, in 2016, the violence were in wealth neighborhoods here in Caracas, Bello Monte, Altamira. I mean, not in what they call the barrios, you know, the popular neighborhoods here in Caracas. But now it happens in a way that it's really interesting. Everything's okay. All of the sudden, like 5 or 10 people comes along, burn tires, ransack supermarkets or pharmacies, and then disappear. But in popular neighborhoods. So you kind of get a sense that well-trained people aiming to create some kind of division in the base.
But they're not catching fire and spreading.
And that's another thing that is interesting, because in 2016, it started like that. But then there was a huge amount in something bigger. And now they are not. Even in the protests that are peaceful protests that are being called by the opposition, you don't see a lot of people. You see that they lost a lot of power of mobilization since 2016.
On NBC, they showed that there were 200,000 people in the opposition in the streets on the 24th.
There was a huge mobilization, but the Chavista mobilization was outnumbered that by a lot. Yesterday, there was one mobilization in support of the government against the coup, because the coup, it's ongoing, right? It's still happening. There was a huge mobilization in the state of Vargas, and you don't see this anywhere. On the 23, for example, the Chavistas, they gathered around Chacao, the same place that bore the opposition, and marched all the way to Olleary Plaza. And it was immense, like thousands and thousands of people. You don't see images of that anywhere, especially on mainstream media.
Obviously, we're talking about two different views of what's happening inside and what we hear outside. One of the things we hear from the outside is that Maduro is an illegitimate leader of Venezuela and that he's a dictator. What can you say about that?
Well, first of all, I think it's really important for us to remember that people use certain words that are concepts very loosely, like humanitarian crisis, dictatorship, refugees. We need to be careful of how we apply them. To this specific case of Venezuela, when they say that Maduro is a dictator, they are contesting the legitimacy of the last presidential elections that were held in March 2018. It's important for us to kind of roll back and remember how that election took place. So in the end of 2017 and beginning of 2018, the government and the opposition held a series of dialogues that were mediated by the government of the Dominican Republic. In those talks, they reached agreement that the government should call for early presidential elections. Historically, presidential elections are held in December here in Caracas, and that elections would have international overview. The government agreed. When they were reaching the agreement, they were ready to sign it. The opposition got a call from, I think it was Mike Pence, but I'm not exactly sure. It was someone from the high ranks of Trump's government. The opposition got a call from that person and called an end to those talks. From then on, an important part of the opposition, the one that has more international contacts, boycotted the elections, called for the Venezuelan people of not getting out to vote. That followed by the refusal of the UN to send electoral observers despite several invitations by the government. Also, the US government said beforehand, months before the elections took place, that it wouldn't recognize the results no matter who won it. So you have elections, people went out to vote, the candidate that got in second place, he recognized the results. There were 18 rounds of re-evaluating the results, and all of them, the candidate that was in the second place recognized that elections, and then the international community refuses to recognize it. I mean, the United States kept calling for democracy in Venezuela and then threatened Enrique Falcón, which is that candidate that got the second place in the presidential elections, with sanctions.
Were there any observers of that election?
Yes, there was a delegation of international observers, including some people from the United States. One of them is lawyer and human rights activist, Dan Kovalik, who has been writing a lot of, you know, the legitimacy of the process, how the electoral process here in Venezuela has a series of safeguards that prevent any rigged elections with the system that they have here. Even Carter Center, former President Jimmy Carter, recognized the Venezuelan electoral systems as one of the best in the world.
A note here. The Carter Center has expressed that their views have been misrepresented by the Venezuelan government. They did indeed help Venezuela build a very secure electoral system in the early 2000s. And in 2018, international electoral observers found that system still functioning well. However, other government actions have sidelined the National Assembly, and some opposition leaders have been jailed for various reasons or fled. In 2019, the Carter Center called on all Venezuelans to, quote, work urgently toward a peaceful political solution with a clear roadmap to restore legitimate democratic governance. They added that, quote, the crisis can only be resolved through the leadership and courage of Venezuelans themselves. Now back to Code Pink's interview with analyst and law professor Aline Piba in Caracas.
Another thing that we hear is that the Maduro government violates human rights.
When you create a narrative about a country, you need to create the elements to support that. So you cannot say you have a dictator that are actually building houses for underprivileged people or bringing universal health care and things like that. When the United States started imposing sanctions, it aggravated an economic crisis that war in the making here. In 2013, 2014, I think it was, there was a serious, very, very serious food shortage in the country. And people started portraying that as if it was the government's fault and not, you know, a consequence of the sanctions that are basically strangling the country's economy. It goes in that line to say we have a repression here or that the government is killing its own people of starvation, when actually it's much more complex than that.
So what human rights do you think Maduro does pay attention to?
Housing. I lived in the United States for 4 years. I lived in Washington, D.C. And you saw there, walking on the streets, how housing is a major problem. I know housing is basic human rights. You need to have conditions to live a dignified life, and housing is one of them. When Chavez came into power, 3.5 million families did not have good conditions of living or did not have a house at all. Now they have built 2.5 million houses. It's something that changes a lot the life of a person. If you can have, you know, a roof under your head, if you can buy subsidized food. We have here basic basket of food that the government sells. It costs about $1.5 and has grains, macaroni, you know, basic goods for the people. And also healthcare, universal healthcare. You live in the United States, you know, people go bankrupt for medicine. But it's important also to note, and I'm sorry that I keep coming back to that, those are achievements that are now under threat by the sanctions. It's very hard to buy, for example, antibiotics here, because the government depends on imports to get those goods in the country, and it's getting harder and harder to do so.
So if they were there, they would be distributed to everyone.
Exactly.
What about education? What's happening there?
We have free and universal education, and there are several of programs here that I think it's very interesting. Alphabetization of seniors. Universities are all free. You don't have to pay. But one that I like the most is the music program that they have. It's a program that is started, and now over 1 million children have pass through it, and it gives the opportunity for underprivileged children to get music education. When you talk about, you know, good living and this kind of quality of life, bringing music to those households, it's very important, right?
The conductor of the Los Angeles Philharmonic came through that program, and he's a Chavista.
Imagine that.
On Wings, you are listening to excerpts from a live-streamed interview between Code Pink co-founder Jody Evans and Brazilian foreign relations analyst Aline Piba, who is now a law professor in Venezuela. They are about to discuss Juan Guaido, who is being proclaimed by many countries as president of Venezuela. Guaido, who studied public administration in Washington, D.C., leads a small opposition party. He was elected president of the National Assembly on January 5, 2019, for a 1-year term. His party, Popular Will, was one of three that boycotted the 2017 mayoral elections and were then banned from contesting for president in 2018.
This installed president by the United States government, how many people know him?
80% of the people here never heard of him. He got a little attention in one of the protests against the government because he brought down his pants and started showing his, you know, yeah. So all of a sudden, that person is the self-proclaimed president of Venezuela. And the United States recognize him, and Brazil recognizes him, and Peru recognizes him. And they expect the Venezuelan people to just accept that. It's a whole new level of meddling in internal affairs.
We hear a little bit about the military being split. What's happening there? What are your concerns there?
The high rank of the military here stood out and said they continue loyal to Maduro. So far, there's only one. He was a military attaché at the embassy in Washington, D.C. He has been actually for quite a few years there. He's not connected with the military base. He was the only one who proclaimed loyalty to Juan Guaido. The military remains loyal to the government. You see a lot of support in the base. People who talk about Venezuela, they overestimate the resentment that the Venezuelan people has over the hardships. And under stress, the resentment that the Venezuelan people has with international meddling. We are talking about a people who are very well educated, who has high levels of political understanding. You cannot just assume that because the United States said that they have a new president, they will just follow this person.
So what we're seeing is that this is being attempted, and the outside and the inside aren't behaving probably how Trump expected.
Inside, this last couple of days made it pretty clear that they don't have the internal support to carry out the coup the way they thought this could be. You know, I think they thought that strangling the economy, putting the government in this very hard position would make Venezuelans switch side, and that did not happen. And that comes to what worries me the most. We know that there is a U.S. involvement. The New York Times published last year that the U.S. governments were holding conversations with coup plotters. Just a couple of days ago, Associated Press published that Juan Guaido was actually in D.C., in Bogota, and in Brasilia holding conversations. What worries me there is that knowing that they don't have internal support, are they willing to go back to more traditional ways of regime change? I mean, are we going to see aggression? Are we going to see something like happened in Libya? Because some of those steps that they took in Libya, they are actually taking with Venezuela. Are we on the brink of that level of aggression?
So when you say some of those steps, could you define them?
One of them is strangle the economy and try to install a parallel government. It's actually hard to believe that it's happening. There are some members of the Supreme Court that actually move it to Florida, Coral Gables, and are sending resolutions from Coral Gables. There are some part of the self-proclaimed government in the exile that are sending resolutions from Bogota, from Spain. So it's serious, but doesn't resonate with the Venezuelan people. I mean, there was this guy, he was the mayor of one of the richest neighborhood here in Caracas, and he recorded a video from DC Metro, like, yes, Venezuelan people, I had to come here to finish my master's, but I'm, you know, doing my best to restore democracy in Venezuela. it was laughable. And the people actually made a lot of fun of it. They are following the same steps, not recognizing the elections, calling Maduro a dictator, doing a media attack, dehumanizing him, dehumanizing the people, dehumanizing the suffering of the people, understressing the sanctions and the consequences of the sanctions. So I think those are kind of worrying signs. And Trump's chief of staff said the U.S. government won't rule out a military intervention in Venezuela.
Then what is Maduro doing to help instill peace instead of violence?
The government is calling the opposition for dialogue at the UN Security Council. Both the Mexican government and the government of Uruguay, they said they would work as mediators for those talks. The government is calling for international organizations to be part of it, to legitimate the process. What the people here are asking for the opposition to go back to the democratic path. I mean, do you want to change the government? Run for the elections. Bring propositions, you know, show to the people that you are actually a viable alternative. Because I think there's a lot of people that would like to have a real opposition that can hold accountable the government, that could do, you know, what is important for a democracy, what makes a democracy a good thing. But the opposition and the United States government, other governments in the region, they have shown time and time again that they prefer a coup that could actually bring violence and a lot of debt and suffer than to try and run free and fair elections.
So what about the claim of corruption that we hear thrown around a lot?
There was a former ambassador, Venezuelan ambassador in D.C., and he used it to say that corruption was like bringing a pizza to a party. It doesn't cost anything and pleases everyone, you know. Corruption is a historical problem, not only in Latin America, but throughout the world. But in Latin America, it's a constant, you know, it's historical. We have that. It's part of our political culture. It's not good, but it's true. But what we are seeing in the past few years is that they are actually using corruption as excuse for regime change. Brazil is a good case in point. Corruption there goes throughout the political spectrum, and there is no political party, you know, almost anyone who is not corrupted there. Probably Dilma Rousseff was the only president that was actually not corrupted in any level, and they took her down. In the 80s was the war on drugs, and now is the war on corruption. And the problem there is they try to use the same own institutions, the very own institutions that are based of the democratic state, to undermine it. They try to do it here in Venezuela. It did not work, but it worked in Brazil. It worked in Honduras. It worked in Paraguay and several other places.
What about the claims? We hear that there are 3 million refugees from Venezuela. Can you shed some light on that?
There's a huge difference between a refugee crisis and a migrant crisis. We are seeing, for example, the Roraima and Yemen and the several places, there are actually a refugee crisis because those people are fleeing for their lives. What we are seeing here in Venezuela is a migrant crisis. UN Special Rapporteur Alfred Zayas came to this conclusion. He presented at a panel in UN in Geneva, stating that people are actually leaving the country in search of better employment, better living conditions. I mean, it's not a secret that sanctions are actually causing a lot of hardships here, but it's not a refugee crisis. And also, there is overestimation of those numbers, because what happens is that someone crosses the border at Colombia and ends up in Argentina, or crosses the border in Brazil, goes to Chile, and ends up in Peru. Those people are being counted 1, 2, 3 times over again. There were a lot of accounts of xenophobic attacks against Venezuelans in Brazil, in Peru, Ecuador. And the government actually started a program to help those people, people who want to come back to Venezuela and did not have the means to come back here. And several thousand of Venezuelans have come back to the country.
You've mentioned the sanctions a bit, and a lot of people don't understand what the U.S. government is doing. Give us a little bit of overview of what's happening there.
When we look at the 14 countries with the largest oil reserves in the world, they were either invaded, they are sanctioned, or they are U.S. allies. It's not the whole picture, but it's actually pretty important. Here in Venezuela, Chavez decided that the revenues of oil exportation should go to improve people's lives. And then what he did was that he deprivatized it. So a lot of the reserves that were gave to private companies are now back to being in the hands of the state, so that revenue could actually go to the people. But the U.S. government did it. They tried everything to regime change here to kind of put back a government that was aligned to their interests. One thing that is the most important thing to note, especially for a U.S. audience, is that they present these as individual sanctions. So we are not sanctioning the country. We are sanctioning these individuals because they are either corrupted or involved in drug trafficking, or they are involved with terrorists. But let's take a step back and look at the people who are sanctioned. It's the president, it's the vice president, it's the minister of finances, high-rank militaries. What these sanctions tell to the international community? This is a country under sanctions. And then the U.S. Treasury Department issued a statement saying that Venezuelan money is probably connected with narco-traffic and terrorism. Do business with them at your own account. We are not responsible of what could happen to you. They are not calling this a blockade. They are not calling this a sanction on the country. But the effects, you know, the actually consequences are that we are under an effective blockade, much the same as they did with Cuba. We actually need more people in the United States to come and say to their governments, please stop meddling. Don't start a war in Latin America. What are the consequences of that? We cannot take politics as if it was a football game.
Aline Piba, a Brazilian international relations analyst and law professor in Venezuela, speaking with Jody Evans, co-founder of the woman-led peace organization Code Pink, on January 27, 2019. As of February 16th, Cuban sources report that U.S. Special Forces troops are being staged in various parts of the Caribbean, possibly with intent to support a Venezuela coup. This edition of Wings was edited and scripted by Sarah Newton and me, Frieda Worden. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. Thanks to our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.